Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Are market trend indicators changing to an uptrend? U.S. GDP disappoints. And Apple and Amazon are amazing. Great numbers from them. All this and much more, our guests, Larry Williams and Mark Hanna, on episode number 261 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And how are you? And I hope you are having a great week, great month. We're calling an end very shortly to April, and May is about to be upon us. Do we have a sell in May, go away, or do we have a buy in May and profits away? We'll see what happens. There are some good indications that the little correction that we saw in April may be coming to an end. And I tell you something, it was quick and very shallow, to say the least, if that's all there is in the market correction. Already the bulls have been able to pull the S&P back over 1,400 and very close to a 2012 high for the Dow Jones Industrial Average, and that's over well over 13,000 at this point. A lot of the countries around the world are still suffering, but the U.S. seems to be doing pretty well in general. And what I mean by that is that while there was a great uptick in many of the markets around the world in the beginning of the year, they really started to slow down and fall off very dramatically over the last couple of months, but the U.S. has been doing pretty well. And a lot of that has to do with earnings. It's not economics, I'll tell you right now. You need the two legs of the stool, though, to really sustain a long-term market uptrend. And we are seeing a lot of negative surprises when it comes to economics. And that's kind of interesting, and we have to watch that. We saw the GDP come in at 2.2%, which was very disappointing. Government spending was down. Business investment was down also. But consumer spending was okay. And some of that had to do with the higher than expected levels of the auto purchases. And we have to see if that's just an effect of the final resolution to some of the Japanese inventory issues that they had after the tsunami, which is still playing some havoc, just real problems when it comes to the supply chain. So we'll see what happens with that. I mentioned that we have two guests on today, so we're going to spend a little time in the beginning here and then get right to them and find out what they have to say. One of them is a mutual fund manager, Mark Hanna, and Larry Williams. We'll call him a trader as well as a trend follower and a cycle follower. I want to talk about the last week and what happened there. We got sideswiped a little bit in our accounts. We were coming into this a little bit short, hedged in our portfolios, and that has been very good for us over the last several weeks. The NASDAQ finally broke its, I think it was a three-week or four-week trend down in terms of its overall performance. It has been negative for many, many weeks. Second week, I believe, for the S&P 500 to be positive. But it was really looking pretty grim. If you saw the dramatic sell-off of many of the growth stocks, particularly those that are related to anything Apple in the Apple supply chain and their whole Apple halo effect that happened in the early part of the week, and then all of a sudden Apple's earnings came out and boom, everything turned around on a dime. Markets climbed. NASDAQ really did well. Volume was up. And many of the companies that are involved with that Apple area, when it comes to their screens, their cameras, anything, really did very well. So that was really interesting. And then we saw some other companies come in. Caterpillar was a bit weak in their latest results. They said that the U.S. was good. But then again, there was some concern about China and Asia slowing down. But you know what? When you look at the various trends, you have to respect what's going on. And there is a lot of powerful bottom buying, bounce buying, a lot of powerful bullishness when it comes to the earnings outlook. So you know what? Don't fight it too much. The fact is that while you are in a situation where you have a downtrend, whether it's a strong or even just a downtrend, you want to be hedged out a little bit, as far as we call it. And then, if it turns on you and you get sideswiped a little bit, that's okay. But, you have to kind of read the tea leaves and kind of go with the flow And it is a lot about the trend because, you know, generally speaking, about 80% of the market movement for an individual stock will be based on the overall movement of markets. And when markets are in a more of a uptrend, you have to respect that. You can still stay short the weaker stocks, but, you know, at the same time, we like to be a little bit more concentrated in individual securities. So what we did was we actually took down some of the positions that were partial positions on Friday, thinned out our hedges much greater than it had been, or almost down to just a small position. And then what we'll do is we will now wade into positions with high growth characteristics, buy some of the dips if it continues on with an uptrend. And at the same time, we will actually go out and concentrate a much higher level of position in any individual stocks that are showing, you know, outsized performance. Now, Apple came in with great numbers, but Amazon came in with some good numbers as well, at least from the market's perspective. Their revenues were better, but at the same time, we saw that the EPS was down substantially. You got to look at that. You got to wonder what is so exciting about that. But again, short squeezes and all that don't hurt. I'll mention also that we have a lot of economics that are coming up. Next week, we have the jobs number on Friday. We have, again, we're going to look at the unemployment rate and the non-farm payrolls. Wednesday, we have the ADP numbers. We have some personal spending numbers coming up on Monday. And, of course, Sunday night, by the time you're listening to this, we'll have had the China manufacturing, the PMI number, come out. It's been solid in terms of just hovering above the contraction zone, or in the, we'll even call it the expansionary zone, for the last several months, and there's a lot of concern of what's going to happen there. The recent flash number, which is the HSBC manufacturing number that came out last week, was better than it was the previous week, but previous month, but at the same time, it was still in the contraction area. So I think that's an important issue that you have to really consider looking at when what's happening. But, you know, you have to wonder, even if China is in a contraction, is it going to really matter that much here, only because we've pretty much blown off any negative news? And as you'll hear a lot of market pundits say, that it's really the reaction to the news more than the news itself that really shapes what goes on with markets. So just keep that in mind. A lot of earnings also coming out, the second tier earnings coming out. We've had close to about, I don't know, how many stocks did come out? A couple hundred stocks have already come out with earnings, some of the big boys, in the beginning of the earnings season, but we're still going to see a lot of things happening and a lot of valuation changes and a lot of variability. You know, you look at what happened this week where Amazon went crazy, Apple went crazy. You had a variety of stocks that showed great earnings, like Western Digital, up 5% after hours, down 13% in the regular market session the next day. And, you know, you're going to have to deal with this kind of being a little nimble around earnings season. Crocs came in with okay numbers, but got it down somewhat. Their stock was down. Silicon Motion, a stock that we held that we really liked, got just obliterated on Friday when they came in with their numbers, which frankly looked pretty good. But there was some question about their memory devices and their slowdown in that area and a little bit of a margin compression. But when you look at it, it's still in our overall list and it's still in our overall screen. So that means that it has to have sequentially good earnings growth, revenue growth, margins, and all that. So we took a little position out of it just on a stop, on a safety measure. It didn't pop back up, but we'll see how that plays out. But, you know, you're seeing a lot of movement. You know, Expedia up 25% and Priceline then moves with it. Caterpillar down 5% on their earnings number. I mean, so there's a lot of this variability happening right now, and investors are looking to either, you know, climb aboard or, you know, bail ship very quickly on a lot of these names right now. So just, you know, get weighed into this very carefully. But at the same time, there are some great opportunities with many of these companies in the U.S. doing very well. So I think that summarized that point. I'll mention also that I thought it was really interesting about what happened after the downgrade of Spain. Spain was downgraded on Thursday evening after the close by Standard & Poor's. Their debt rating was downgraded from A+ to a triple B plus, A- to a BBB+. And that took down the euro, that took down the S&P futures about 5-6 points after hours. And then you wake up in the morning and it's like nothing happened. It's almost like when S&P downgrades, it's actually good, because in a way, you eliminate some of the uncertainty in the markets. Is that possible? You eliminate, well, what if? What is it going to be? Could it be worse? They put them on negative watch, but at the same time, the euro rallied, or the dollar sank, whichever way you want to look at it, after the GDP number. And at the same time, you know, of course, Bernanke spoke last week after his minutes came out from the FOMC meetings. And while the minutes were much more hawkish, somehow everybody read into all the good news that Bernanke's still very dovish. So the dollar sank dramatically over the last few days. Even as it spiked up twice throughout the week, it just got sold off and just got sold off. Bonds are just sitting there doing nothing. Stocks had a great week, generally speaking. And a lot of that, again, thanks to Apple and Amazon and some of the big names. But, you know, the bottom line is that the market is still very susceptible to moves in the dollar. Dollar weakening is good for stocks. That's the bottom line of it. Oil jumped up to about $105, which is not so good for the consumer. But again, you know, there's a lot of thought out there that right now the consumer is pretty resilient, and that's going to hold the markets in place. So anyway, that's what's happening. Well, next week we've got to watch to see what's going to happen with some of the French elections. We're going to have to see what happens with the China economics, and that's what we're really going to be in focus in, and we'll talk about that. I will say that I didn't think GDP was very good, and I would dare say that putting China's number aside for a second, most of the international markets are not going to be too happy about our lackluster GDP. So there you go. I want to mention two things before we get to our guest. Number one, I want to tell you about a special we're going to have on Trigger Point Research, which is, by the way, doing great in terms of subscribers are coming on board. We've had some really good calls, a couple of little nuggets that aren't great. We got stopped out on a couple that turned around, one or two that didn't do well. But generally speaking, you know, now that we are changing our market trend, you know, now we have an opportunity to really do some good work in terms of the upside breakouts. And if that happens, we'll see a lot more of those coming in. And we've seen a few of those over the last several weeks. But, you know, you concentrate more on the bounce plays and the breaking down when the market's in a downtrend, and then the opposite in a market uptrend. So I'll mention that in a second. I'll tell you what I have for you. But also I want to mention that this podcast is, of course, sponsored by GoToMeeting. And GoToMeeting is really cool. As a matter of fact, coming up shortly, we're going to have some GoToMeeting meetings or conferences where we're going to kind of go through the trigger points, go through the different ways we manage money, some of the ideas we have, some great stock ideas and all that. We're going to do that through a GoToMeeting platform. So I'll let you know about that. Make sure you pay attention to the Twitter feed, Andrew Horowitz, and make sure you go to the website, thedisciplinedinvestor.com is where we're going to have the announcements of that. But GoToMeeting, what we like about it so much is that you kind of get right on with people. You could do it in a group of one or many thousand. And you can actually share your screen, discuss things, be live with your browser and showing what's going on or any other application that you have, show a PowerPoint presentation, and share that in real time very easily without any ridiculous amounts of software and problems and all that. There's a voice over IP integration, neat stuff available through GoToMeeting. It's by Citrix, which had a great quarter, by the way. You can get your own free 30 days of GoToMeeting very easily by going to GoToMeeting.com and go to the Try It Free button and use the promo code podcast, and you get 30 days of free GoToMeeting with all the frills, all the buttons and wizards and things that you can do with it. The whole thing. I mean, just from soup to nuts, you get the whole program, the whole system, the whole subscription for free. GoToMeeting.com. Click on the Try It Free button, and then use the promo code podcast. I'll also mention that for the this is a May special for the first 2 weeks of May. Anybody that signs up for Trigger Points Research, for any of the subscriptions that we have there, you're going to get a copy of both The Disciplined Investor and The Winning Investor, and I'll sign those, absolutely free. So you can get the breaking up, the breaking down. You can get the pro package, which is a combination of all of those, or and you get also the bouncing updates, which is a little bit of a different in the pro package. The only way you can get the bounce updates is through the pro package. Any one of those, you'll get a free copy. We'll send it right to you of The Disciplined Investor, the book, and also The Winning Investor book. So make sure if you want to do that, it's going to be for the first 30 days only. Did I say that? I'm sorry. I'm going to back up. Well, I said it, so I guess I'm going to have to go with it now. For 30 days, okay, I'll do it. But 30 days of May, we'll do that. And anybody that signs up for Trigger Point Research, you'll do that. Just we'll mention that that you get a free copy of those books. So check that out in May. That's our May special for Trigger Point Research. I think you'll really enjoy that. And if you're looking to trade, you're looking to do some of that. And, of course, if you want to check out what we're doing over here, some of the things that we're doing, check out the virtual tour over at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. You find out all about the TDI managed growth strategy and what's going on. If you've been a little confused about markets, you don't know what to do. Should I go long, short? That's what we do. Anyway, with that, I wanted to spend some time with Mark Hanna. He is the portfolio manager of the Paladin Long Short Mutual Fund, symbol PALFX, and a prolific writer and a tweeter, blogger, and also a mutual fund manager. One of the things that we talk about quite often, we follow a similar kind of process of growth funds we both like, and we look at market overall. And one of the interesting things that we had a discussion earlier in the week was about the Investor's Business Daily call earlier in the week, turning from a market in correction to a market uptrend. So, Mark, how are you?
Good. How are you doing?
Good. Life of a mutual fund as a manager is still suiting you well?
Yeah, absolutely. It's definitely my passion in life. So it's hectic, but every day is a challenge and interesting and fun.
Right. Are you like going out to dinners every night with steak dinners with people, and you got a big boat yet?
None of those yet. Give me about 20 years, maybe.
Okay. All right. Well, that's a goal. That's a goal. That's great. All right. So let's talk a little bit about the market as a whole, and then because that's something that you really focus in on, I know, because that really has an overriding factor on – obviously on stocks. We talked about the Investor's Business Daily, which you and I both read amongst a variety of other things, and I, you know, pay close attention to some of their calls because they've been pretty good. What's your take on the recent change of trend that happened last week?
Well, as you know, I believe it was last right after the Apple earnings Wednesday, they've changed their stance to back to market and uptrend. I'm not sure if that's the exact terminology.
I think it's a confirmed uptrend, I think they call it, confirmed uptrend.
Yeah, and, you know, just getting a little bit of background, I don't have the exact date in April, but they have a couple kind of transitional terms, and again, don't quote me on exactly what they are, but the last of them is market and correction. And there's market under pressure, and then, you know, there's market and uptrend and that sort of thing. So they had under pressure, I think, very late March or very early April, and then market and correction happened, I think, around the 6th, 7th, or 8th, somewhere around there, right around when there was the jobs report that the markets were closed in the United States on that Friday, and we came back the following Monday, and there was a large gap down. So I believe IBD either went right before that or right at that date and said, you know, we're in a downtrend. So as you know, people, as your listeners know, we've had a very volatile up and down April, and so they've been correct. It's kind of a time. That's why even if we're going to go, that kind of calls out, hey, we're going to go drop 20% from here. It's kind of, you know, hit the sidelines. You know, take back your positions. Get the less exposed at the minimum, and let the market do what it does. You don't know if it's going to be a 3% correction, a 5% correction, or a 20% correction. You just know that there's a potential there for some volatility and downward movement. So they're pretty good on that part. Now, what's kind of surprising, as me and you two have talked beforehand on this call, it was a quick turnaround back to going back to, you know, a constructive market, or market in uptrend, or whatever their terminology is, which was Wednesday, I believe, this week. Usually it takes longer because that was only about a 2 to 3 week period where, you know, it was under pressure, and then we're back to uptrend. But historically, let's explain what that means. Basically, over history, they've you know, studied this hundreds of years. Like, I don't know how far they've gone back. 1880s is what they like to say, which is a long time. there's never been a bull move upward without one of these things called a follow-through day, which is FTD in acronym world. And what that is, basically, while you're in a correction, there's going to be rally attempts. So any up day is considered day one of a rally attempt. Then any period, any session, 4 to 10 days after a rally attempt begins, you want to have a day where the market is at 1.7%, and you might ask, what's the market? It could be any of the major indexes, Dow, NASDAQ, S&P 500, any of them do fine. 1.7% up on higher volume than the previous session. So as everybody knows, you know, the market was under a lot of pressure. Then Apple, the magical company that changes the world, reported earnings Tuesday evening. Market shot up Wednesday, and NASDAQ was up over 1.7% on more volume than the previous day. And so that was IBD's call to tentatively, even they were cautionary, even the way they used it. I'm not sure what the exact word was, but it was a modest we're back to uptrend, kind of, or we hope, we think. And so it wasn't we're 100% trusting in that sort of thing, but they were, well, this is a follow through day, and if you're following this methodology, again, it's not, don't go 100% long at this moment, don't throw all your chips in, but get more constructive is kind of the way they were going. Now the past 2 days since then have been strong, and so they've done pretty well so far, so we'll see how it goes from here. There's obviously just like you spoke about, you don't want to put all your eggs in one basket, but it's one tool out of many you might want to use or not want to use. But it's got a pretty good track record.
Yeah.
Let me add one more thing. In history, from the 1880s, there's never been a bull move without one of these follow-through days happening. So from that perspective, you need to have one for a sustaining upward move. Now, on the flip side of that, there are false positives to it. Just because you have a follow-through day doesn't mean you're going to have a sustained upward move. The track record is about 70% follow-through, meaning every 10 times it happens, you're going to have 3 false positives. So, just like you said, you can't throw all your eggs in one basket and say, well, just because they said there's a follow-through day, we're going to be off to the races. But we can't have an upward move without it, historically. And when it happens, there's a 70 to 30% chance that it's going to work, which in the market, if you have anything that works better than 50-50 or a coin flip,
yeah,
it's something to take notice of.
Yeah, clearly. Now, one of the things, because I also follow this, let me just clarify a couple of points here. So one of the things you have is that the move that happened, and I think the reason why they're tentative on a follow-through day here was because the incredible volume of Apple and the amount of move that was attributable to Apple for the NASDAQ in particular was outsized. All right, I'm not trying to pick it apart too much, but just kind of give some further color to what's going on. I think that's why they were tentative about it. The second thing is that the last time they had a follow-through day, I believe it was the last time, there was a 14-day period after that that the markets were down afterwards. So they're kind of a little bit mixed on that. And in addition to that, it was a short period of time. Really, they started counting. The initial rally attempt was only about 2 or 3 days after they called the correction. And then they called the follow-through day on Wednesday. And again, market days were talking. The final thing is that when they look at what happened recently, there was a tremendous amount of distribution and lopsided amount of movement in that the materials companies just got squashed terribly. And a variety of other companies, the banks and all that, really got hurt for a little while there and a few others. But really, the technology has been the shining star here. I mean, just look at Amazon and Apple and the Apple effect, the halo effect, with all the companies that really shot up after the Apple earnings. And those were all, again, attributable to the Apple supply chain that really said, wow, you sold how many iPhones, And that means, how many cameras and chips and screens and cases and blah, 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 that goes all into it. So I think that's some of the reason why they were a little tentative, and the fact that the volume wasn't that dramatic on some of the other indices. But anyway, that's right. The point of why they're tentative. To get to our level, our market trend indicator is a 3-part component. We use a couple of other different indices as well to kind of give us final confirmation. We're in an uptrend now as of Friday's close, which means to us, at least, that you want to be careful on your shorting. You want to be careful on tightening stops. You want to buy dips rather than necessarily sell the rips per se. You want to get yourself into position that may be a little bit more concentrated in certain securities for opportunity on the upside, and look for short squeezes. That's kind of the play. Again, that's our side. But let's talk a little bit about, now that we know a little bit about Investor's Business Daily, which we like, and I really encourage everybody to go check out their newspapers, especially their Monday special edition, which has a lot of good information in there. There's been some really outsized gains on certain stocks, and it's interesting to note that analysts had really dropped their estimates down dramatically over the last several months. And what we're seeing is not anything more than a nice beat by many of them. But just look at Amazon on Friday. Amazon shot up 15%, which is pretty unusual for a stock that size and for a stock that earnings have come down so dramatically. They really just beat on the revenues. Their earnings were nothing to be excited about, right?
I followed it from afar, but I saw there was some actual, I don't know, there was accruals that were moved around or tax, you know, abatements or whatever. But the problem with a stock like Amazon, it's a story stock. There's, you know, its valuation. It's not a stock that you trade on valuation. It's overpriced on almost or overvalued on a ton of metrics, but it's one of those game changers. It's basically the Walmart of online trading. So in my opinion, and we talked about this very briefly before we got on this interview, it was a heavily shorted stock. It hasn't had a great year, or lately, let's put it this way, in the past couple months. And I think if you're a short seller and you see, I think it was up in after hours, you know, tremendously. It was up over $20, you know, 10, 12%. You have to make the decision, am I going to stick through it the next day or get the heck out? And those type of things feed on each other. So really, the data, the initial reaction to the data is more important than what the data is. You know, you and I could sit there and intellectually deconstruct the income statement and say, oh, my God, why are people so excited or why are they not excited? But in the short run, it really doesn't matter. The momentum was for the longs. Short started covering, and there's enough of a short position. Once some people start covering, it kind of feeds on itself. Now that's a situation for Friday. It might change by next Tuesday or by next Friday, or it might continue on from here. I don't know, but you know, speaking to your larger point, back in October, November last year, you know, people were thinking there was going to be a recession in Europe, which is coming true. We just saw the United Kingdom come and announce that they're back in recession. Spain, everybody knows, is just in terrible shape. But again, U.S. corporations are working miracles. They've cut so much costs out, and they've lowered their expectations for this quarter. Back in, they were doing it last September, October. So the beats are our beats versus expectation. And in the short run, that's what people are impressed by. But looking year over year, you know, not just Amazon, but a lot of these companies, their year over year numbers are not that great, the results. But versus the lowered expectations, which is all what Wall Street cares about in the short run, they're beating. And that gets you breathless headlines on CNBC or in the newspapers. You know, beat by X percent. And if you look over history, the past 50, 20 years, the run rate of beating is 75, 80%. So there's a game being played. You know, Andrew knows this really well. It's a Wall Street game. Yep. Basically, try to make the companies look good, because a lot of these companies that are giving ratings, they have business arms, you know, investment banks that want to do... when these companies do debt offerings, they want to be part of that business. If they issue new stock, or they do a merger, they do a purchase, they want to get their hands on all that business. So there's a relationship going on in the background where they don't want to make the companies upset. So the game is companies undersell, they beat, they set a number, they beat it by a little bit, and everybody can clap about how they constantly beat expectations. So the analysts kind of understate what they can do, and everybody's happy, and you get these happy headlines. So it's all a little bit of a game. You can take
so,
it from there.
So what you're saying is that we're sheep.
No, if you know what's happening, you kind of just sit there and laugh about it.
Right.
But a lot of people, I'm just shocked how much influence analysts have personally. When I see a stock shoot up 8% because of an analyst upgrade, it doesn't make much sense to me. If you go look at, there's a pet peeve of mine, I've written many times about this. There are almost no sells on Wall Street. Neutral rating on Wall Street is a sell, is a wink, wink.
Right.
Sell. That's as negative it's going to get. if you look at the whole spectrum, there's like 3% of ratings are sell. Now, think about all the companies in the United States. Are only 3% of them, or 3% of the analyst ratings, should they be negative? No, they obviously should not. But it goes back to the game. Earnings season. Now, let's give some credit, Andrew. They are, U.S. corporations have done a great job of managing their balance sheets and, purging labor and beating numbers. They actually have done a great job. And so far, I think there's been 200 of the 500 S&P 500 companies have reported, and they are reporting about 6% growth versus the expectation of about 1% year over year. So there has been There's been growth. I'm going to give them some credit. It's not
Let me again fill in some color here. 70% of the companies have beat so far that have put out their estimates, which is a little bit below the long-term average, but okay, still within the range. I think 7% is the actual number of the beat, but without Apple, it would be 4%. Apple has, again, an unusual amount of sway on this. But still, 4% is okay. It's not great. Is it great enough to bring the stock market to its previous high? No. In total, that is. I mean, you know, individual stocks are a different story entirely. But the overall beat level of what we're seeing is, you know, the new game is 2 cents. You can't beat by 1 cent. You have to beat by 2 cents and at least come in on revenue somewhere at or above. And right now, the big ticket is revenue, which is interesting because you would think that EPS is really something considered important because if they really cut all of their costs to the bone as best as possible, maybe not their input costs, but their labor costs and maybe all the other peripherals that they had, brought down their cost for funding through their balance sheet and rebalancing their debt, et cetera, you would think that if they have higher revenue, they should really at this point be a higher net, which also goes to the question of, you know, what's happening with margins. I mean, there is some margin pressure that's going on comparatively.
Yeah, we've had 2 quarters, I believe it was the third or fourth quarter of 2011 was really the peak of this cycle. And last quarter was some reduction in profit margins. So, but what I would also say to your listeners, I don't know how you do it, Andrew. I don't really look at EPS that much, to be honest with you, because EPS is a game. There's a lot, I worked in corporate finance, not that places I worked in games, but just I'm saying that there's a lot of things you can do with earnings. And I'm not saying manipulate, I'm saying within the law, within the rules. It's almost impossible to lie about revenue. And if you do, you're pretty much, you know, you're Enron and you're going to be going to jail.
Or Groupon.
Well, SEC.
Yeah, those guys are from your neck of the woods up in Michigan.
They're in Chicago.
One of the guys is from Michigan.
Yeah. Don't pay me with the group.
No.
They've had a lot of fun with the SEC already, you know, even before pre-IPO. But revenue, I like to look at revenue. I think revenue growth, it's there or it's not there. You know, you can have flat revenue, and if you do the right cost cutting, or, you know, even like banks have reserves they can discharge or whatever, and you can have EPS growth. There's a lot of ways to get EPS growth with very modest or even negative revenue growth. So I like, you know, we like growth stocks. We like stocks that are, you know, leadership stocks, and they have secular growth stories. And you find that in revenue. If you're just looking at EPS growth year over year, it can be very, very. There's a lot of companies I've seen with negative revenue year over year, and their EPS can charge because, like I said, they take out costs. They might be very heavily based on a certain commodity that has dropped year over year, which is a benefit, but that's not telling you. That's something sustainable for them to grow. So I would look at revenue. You know, if you're someone listening to this and you're analyzing companies on a fundamental basis, look at those companies growing revenue. If you're trying to find something that's going to have a lasting, that's something that's going to be more than one or two quarter of a story. But yeah, profit margins have come in. So these companies, as a whole, in the United States, they've had a tailwind the past couple of years where, you know, again, they've cut a lot of labor costs out. They're getting a lot of tax benefits from the government, for capital expenditures and that sort of thing. Some of that stuff has expired this year. So they're going to be struggling now from here to grow EPS. So the better companies, as a benefit for investors, you're really going to have it's going to be a lot easier to identify the companies that are growing on a secular basis due to their business as opposed to this tailwind of, you know, we cut 30% of our workforce, we got these massive abatements from the government, and that sort of thing. So, this is a challenge for the U.S. Companies right now. They're lean and mean, but they've done the easy part of cutting out their costs. And Asia slowing down, China slowing down, Brazil slowing down, and that's where a lot of the multinational growth has come from. So, who has the, you know, who's in mobile internet? Who's in, these sector trends that are growing no matter what happens with the U.S. economy or the European economy or that sort of thing. Those are the things you want to be looking for.
So let's switch over for a second and talk about the discussion that I think we have to have with regard to China, but also Europe. You know, Europe, yeah, you mentioned that the U.K. has gone back into a recession. As a matter of fact, it is an official double dip recession because they didn't get to the peak of their last peak. So therefore, it's a double dip, whatever that means. But they're in a recession, a slight one. Spain clearly has their unemployment rate is notched up to 25%.
And they're in depression. They're in a depression.
Yeah, they're in a terrible depression. And also their young workers under 25 is up at about 50%. And you look at Italy and Greece and all that. We know the situation there. Germany actually has been doing well, although confidence has been slowing down about their future. You know, China has clearly seen, we're going to see late on Sunday evening, the results of their PMI. The HSBC came in a little bit better, but still in contraction on their flash index. And India is just a mess these days. The you know, what's your take on the effect, the potential effect of a slowing European environment on the U.S.? Because at this point, it doesn't seem to have too much of an impact. But at the same time, we look at Caterpillar and their commentary after the earnings said, is interestingly, that you know China was slowing, Europe is slowing, and the U.S. is picking up, which
exactly.
is kind of opposite the discussion that we yeah. saw a year and a half ago.
Right. And it's kind of funny, you know the term decoupling, and it was made famous in 2007, 2008, and it became very wrong at that point that what decoupling was, the U.S. is going to, or U.S. countries can decouple from each other. China can continue on and being strong, and the U.S. won't be affected, or Europe won't be affected by the U.S. at that point, because that's when the U.S. was the leader downwards of our you know, financial crisis here.
It was our fault.
It was our fault. That's right. Well, what's happening in Europe is important for your listeners to understand, and I'm sure you've had other guests talk about this. They have, before we go to, you know, all these counter effects of one country to the other, they did an experiment, whatever it was, 20 years ago with the euro, and think of Europe right now as the United States. And what I mean by that is, think of their countries as our states, meaning let's call Germany, California, let's call France, New York, Greece could be, you know, I don't want to besmirch any kind of Vermont, so whoever. So they have an issue. In the United States, you know, we have a fiscal authority that covers the whole country. We have a central bank that covers the whole country. They have a European central bank, which is doesn't have the flexibility of ours, that is similar to the Fed. So they have, you know, ECB, which we talk about all the time. But what they're lacking is they don't have a fiscal authority that runs the whole region. So they have a currency that covers whatever number of countries. There are 17, I believe, they're using it, and 23 in the Euro region or whatever it might be. Don't quote me on those numbers, but they have that many states. And it's the largest economy in the world if you take them all together, larger than the United States. But the problem is the currency is the problem over there. There's major issues between the countries. We wouldn't be having this issue in Europe if they were independent. All we'd have a lot of countries in recession still, but they would be able to do what the United States, Japan, UK have done, and that's quote unquote print a lot of money, devalue their currency. They'd have to do a lot more. Like someone like Spain or Greece would have to do something a lot more stronger than what anything Japan, United States, or the UK has done. But they can't do that because they're locked. They're locked into this common currency that is trading basically on Germany and France, because those are the two largest members and the two strongest members in the region. And Germany has been a powerhouse. So their currency is overstated or much higher than it should be for states like Spain, Portugal, Ireland, Greece, and those Italy, and then it's it's advantageous for countries like Germany, which has become an export powerhouse due to a currency in part, due to a currency right now that is it should be much higher. The Swiss franc, which is still independent versus the euro, has rallied incredibly because you know, Switzerland's a strong country; it's a fiscally competent country. And people are treating it as a safe haven. If the German mark was still around on its own, Germany would be facing the same issues in terms of a much higher currency. But so there's a kind of a, because they're in a shared currency, they're getting the quote-unquote benefit of what's happening in all the weaker member states. So what the issue is, let's go back to Iceland, which I don't know how familiar your listeners are to Iceland. Iceland was in worse than Greece 3-4 years ago. They are a tiny country, I think about 100,000 people, something around there, 100,000, 200,000 people. but they had a couple banks that just went crazy. They, you know, they went Lehman, they went Bear, they went they went crazy on their you know, the same thing that happened to the rest of the world, and they owe these mostly British banks just a ton of money. Now, what they decided to do, they were independent, though. They were not part of the EU, and they said to the rest of the, basically the British banks, we're not going to pay you back.
Yeah, screw you. Screw you.
You made very stupid loans. You gave us way too much money. You let us go crazy, and we took it. And, you know, the choice of that moment was, do we sit here and put our people under this crazy austerity for the next 10, 20 years to pay back these stupid loans, or do we just basically say, you're screwed, we're walking away? They devalued their currency. They went through a very rough time for about a year and a half, and now they about 2 quarters ago they went back. Their economy is thriving again, booming again, and because they defaulted on all those loans, this is the irony. People want to give them money because it's a lot like General Motors. Once you get rid of all that old debt, you're a very good credit profile. You have a very good credit profile going forward. So that they could get away with that because they're not part of the EU. Now, again, the rest of these countries, that's what Greece should have done. This is what Portugal should have done. This is what Ireland should have done. When I say should, I'm not morally saying it's right or wrong. I'm saying, the world has a history of default. Greece has been in default, I think, about half their history since they've been independent. Argentina does it every 20 years. Russia does it every 20 years. So they just make stupid decisions, and people continue to give them money. But unfortunately, now they're stuck in this union with each other, and they don't have this flexibility, I guess is what I'm trying to get to. It's a lot like if California doesn't have the flexibility to go and default on its own loans. It can't, because it's part of the United States. Now, what California has, or Illinois has, or New York, or any country that, or any state that's in trouble, and we saw this in early 2009, they have the benefit of a federal government over them that gave them a ton of money. Obviously, they pay taxes in and to the federal government. But in times of crisis, we can do a huge fiscal program, which we did, and we've helped the states. There is no authority in Europe to do that. There's no federal government that says, well, you know what, Greece is really screwed. We're going to give them, we're going to print out, $80 billion and just hand it to them. We can do that in the United States, to California, to Texas, to whoever needs it. They can't do that over there, and that's
Mark. But what's really weird is that the euro, even though it came down recently, is still extremely high compared to all the things that are going on. You know, we saw the downgrade of Spain, but yet the euro rallied. And what's really interesting is that you have to wonder if they're trying to be more competitive overall. And even if it is Germany who's holding a lot of the economic stability there, the fact remains that you have to wonder why there's still such a bid in the euro.
Well, look at all the other countries, though. What is every other country? Who are they competing with? They're competing with Japan, the yen, the dollar, the pound. What are all those central banks doing? They're all printing and queuing to death. Japan just announced.
But even when the LTRO came in, $1 trillion, which is essentially a money printing operation, the euro, it actually strengthened dramatically. It went opposite of what you thought it would do.
Right, but currencies are all relative to other currencies.
Right.
What was the United States was doing? Operation Twist. The UK did a QE, I'm not sure exactly what time it was, January, December, and Japan is just another QE yesterday. They announced it yesterday, or overnight. So all these guys we're all debasing, and that's why the gold bugs are, that's why gold has probably tripled since, 300 or more than tripled, but doubled from 2007, 2008, from 700, 800 to 1500, and that's why there's still a constant bid there. I know it's been a little bit weak the past couple months, but all these countries that have paper money are doing the same thing. So when you say, you're right from a point of view where you're like, oh my God, look what's happening in Europe. It's really, really bad. But what is Greece? In the United States, Greece is not even Vermont, or it's the equivalent of Vermont. Who cares? I mean, it sounds harsh, but who cares? All that matters really in the UK or in the EU is Germany, France, Italy, and Spain. Those I don't know what percentage they are of the entire economy, but I think Germany by itself is like 25%. I think France is 20, and then you're down to like 15 or 20% for the other two. So those are the big four. So the real part of this crisis is Spain and Italy. You know where things are with those two and how they're going to turn out. So we're getting to the end of the beginning as opposed to the beginning of the end. Or what are we getting? How do we say it? We're getting to the beginning of the end. I think we're getting to the beginning of the end because there's going to be a resolution here with Spain and Italy over the next couple of years. And the one that worries me, though, is France. Because if you look at France's fiscal situation, it's not that much better than a lot of the other ones, but they seem to get a pass on everything. I'm not sure why.
Well, they have to get a pass right now. We'll see what happens after the election. We're going to have to end it there. This is Mark Hanna of the Paladin Long Short Mutual Fund, PALFX. Where else can they find you?
I have a blog, Market Montage, MarketMontage, and I blog about economics and the general market there quite often, and some interesting companies.
Yeah, great stuff, and I really encourage you to read his work, and we will continue this because I think the saga is not over when it comes to Europe, and we'll see how this market timing call, if you want to call from IBD, and the market actually holds up at these levels, especially with employment numbers coming out next week. Again, Mark Hanna from the Paladin Long Short Mutual Fund, PALFX. Thanks for joining me today. I appreciate it.
Thanks a lot, Andrew. Take care.
All right, bye-bye. And back by popular demand, we have Larry Williams, a fund manager, a trader, and from iReallyTrade.com. And Larry and I have been, we struck up a friendship some time ago, and he is a master of the game, so I thought we would get him in here because one of the things that he talked about in his annual letter, one of the things that is highly coveted by investors, is he does a long-term read on markets and gives a kind of a blueprint, a map, of where markets will be trending throughout the year. So, Larry, I thought we'd talk a little bit about that and go over that. How are you doing?
Great. Real fine. Thank you. The market's responded pretty much so far, knock on wood, like we thought it would. And in our fund, we're out of everything except one stock with a trailing stop. I think we're in the area of in the area of a significant high here.
Yeah, it's interesting because one of the things that see, all these investors are calling Larry for advice. It's all right. It's a podcast. It's not radio, I guess. Here's the thing. Yeah. So one of the things that's interesting is that even though the VIX doesn't really identify it, and even though the market doesn't really identify it as a whole, we're seeing a lot of volatility, a lot of kind of crazy movement of stocks, aren't we?
Well, we are. I think that's typical of what happens at a market top. You get bad stocks like that shouldn't come down, like Fastenal, one of the all-time great growth stocks ever.
Yep, yep.
That's been really weak in here. And you get the Apple, it opens up on a big gap with earnings and can't hold the gap.
Right.
And you get other stocks that are catching up in here. And I think that's probably a sign of distribution.
It seems like a sign of distribution. And also it seems like a lot of short covering going on because a lot of the stocks that have been moving recently have really been those with a very high short interest. So you think that it's almost like, all right, let's go through some distribution here, but also let's try to whack up and get people to short cover so we can make a quick buck on that on the other side?
Well, that kind of precludes that there's somebody who's masterminding the market.
Yeah, there's not.
I don't know if that's happening, but I think that there's enough emotions in the marketplace that we've seen this big rally up in prices this year. So a lot of the public and funds are going, oh, I got to get aboard. I got to get aboard. And there's any of them or, you know, last November, October. And so those guys are coming late to the party here. And I think that's what makes for the volatility.
Yeah. So one of the things, let's go over, you put out a piece at the end of the year last year, and you did a bit of a roadmap. And can we talk a little bit about why you had that, some of the philosophy of that, and then how you actually execute on that?
Sure. What I do is it works best on the stock market because we have data on the Dow Jones Industrial Average for 113 years now. And I look at the very long-term cycles, 100-year cycle, 23-year cycle, whatever, combine those all together in one segment. Then I look at the typical seasonal patterns from 1950 forward, combine that in one box, if you will. Then I take last year's pattern that we saw in 2011 and find all years that had a pattern pretty similar to 2011, and then look at what happened the next year's and put those in a third box, then together, gives a pretty reliable roadmap of what's going to happen in the future,
right?
Which called for a big rally at the first of the year and a top somewhere in now. I forget the exact date. That isn't the big issue, but we're real close to the exact date is. Exact high is like May 16th.
Right. So now
in here and then have a little bit of a rally, which is what we're in now. But this rally is leading up to the high in the market.
Right. So now one of the things that I found of interest was, when you mentioned that you want to look for a year like last year, for example, then compare the year after that. What year in history do you recall? I don't know if you recall, but what year in history was like 2011? Because that was one big choppy mess.
Well, I'd have to. Let's see if I can pull up my program to do that. I devise that. And so it's all done. And I don't recall it because it's all done by computer, obviously.
Thank goodness for computers. what would we do without them?
Let's see. I can pull that up for you. And we can go back in time and see what years were similar to the year last year. And I'm doing that just as we talk.
All right, and we're doing a little time filler here. So just
yeah.
By the way, if anybody wants to check out Larry's work, it's at ireallytrade.com. Like as in, really? No, that really. ireallytrade.com. Yeah, for real. Yeah. Not just talking the talk. He's walking the walk and eating the dog food, as we say.
Yeah, that is one difference. I'm primarily a commodity trader. As I run a fund that's a relatively small fund. And but basically I'm a trader. 2002 was pretty similar. And 2008 was pretty similar. In terms of the pattern where we went down and we had that rally
right
into the end of the year. But what happens is the cyclical pattern, not just exactly, we don't get the same moves every year, but when we top and bottom along the way, tend to be pretty consistent. And so I put those in as part of the mix, but I'm still looking at the seasonal structure of the marketplace and the very long-term cycles. 2004 was pretty similar, and I see like 1911 was similar as well.
1911?
Mm-hmm.
Interesting, because I don't remember 1911, but I knew I do.
You don't.
No. But I do remember all those other years, and that's interesting because now that you mention it, I do remember all of the craziness of 2002 was pretty ugly, and right. There's a lot of choppiness in there. And 2008, obviously. 2004, you said 2004 too, right?
Flat, and we had that rally at right. the end of the year, which is right. what we had last year.
Right. And then also I remember 1994, I guess that's not in your mix, but that was a kind of similar, if I recall correctly, that was a similar feel. It was a crazy year where markets looked okay, but yet at the same time they were, you know, just downright, a lot of stocks were obliterated. So moving on onto the area of commodities just for a second here, because I know that is part of your expertise. You know, the Bernanke put, the Bernanke discussion, the Bernanke is constantly, whenever he shows his pretty little beard, the dollar gets whacked, whether rightfully or wrongfully, it just does. You know, you see a downgrade of Spain recently, and overnight the euro moves high, moves lower, the dollar moves higher, and then magically it turns around on a dime the next day when you see that whatever the excuse is this time, the GDP was light, you know, and then the stock market goes up. I mean, this is really doing a lot of creating a lot of volatility for commodities, isn't it?
Well, it is, but let's talk for a moment about the long picture. I was in China last week lecturing at SAFE, like their Wharton School of Finance, and I sat down with my professor friends there and talked about what the heck China's intent is with their currency. And they made it real clear, Andrew, it's a 10-year program from now to have that should be the world currency in their view. Now, I don't think it's going to happen, but that's going to be their concerted effort to have that happen, right. And I think we need to understand that
world domination of the currency. And I mean that may be their intent, and by strengthening it, obviously, which we want them to do, also it provides right for that kind of concept. Although I think that there's going to be a lot of competition from other places that are doing that. On the other hand, you know, you don't know how much of other currencies that China's going to buy up and then kind of corner the market per se on a lot of that.
They have our debt, so.
Right. Right.
How strong can their yuan be with right. our debt?
Right. So that
China's got a lot of economic problems, which I think eventually will lead actually to a higher dollar. I don't think that the dollar is dead. It just has so much overhead supply in.
Right.
Really hard to get it to rally.
It's very difficult, even in the face of but you know, it's also investor sentiment. It's the game that they play. When you saw the Fed minutes come out, or the meeting notes, and the dollar rallied, or when you saw that was one rally. Then Bernanke talking knocked it down. Then you saw the big rally. There was a real quick move when Spain was demoted, if you will. And then it just the next day it came down. Any excuse to kill the dollar seems to be in play. And obviously we know a lot of the players who are doing that. And you know, the euro is a big play here too.
That does make us more competitive as a country because we're cheap. But at what point will that stop? I think probably July of this year, middle of July. That's what my work suggests. We should get some type of a rally attempt in here. And
I mean, you keep cutting out a little bit here and there. I don't know what's going on, just on the important points.
I'm sorry. My work suggests that July of this year, we should see the dollar rally.
Mm. So that being the case, your original work on the cycle for this year was all about kind of rallying the beginning of the year, sometime into about now, May, somewhere around there. And then a similar kind of summer sell in May concept, I guess. And then you see some further problems, I think, July, if I'm not mistaken, right? Because of this.
In the stock market now,
right?
Like the dollar.
Right, in the stock market. And then what was the end of the year?
Now, this is interesting. I think there's just a great play here. And it is that we will rally before the election, regardless of who wins. This is what almost always happens. Then after the election, the fact is out. The dirty dog won or lost. The market pulls back and goes like, well, what's going to happen now?
Right.
And then it doesn't matter who wins, the market rallies.
Hmm.
So I think shortly after the election is going to be a great buying point in the market.
Right, after it drops down. Obama
wins or Romney wins, we'll pull back a little bit and we'll get, well, okay. And then all of a sudden, boom, we're going to blast out of that price zone.
Right. Well, because of course they wanted that. Because of course it's the old presidential cycle in a way that they're just going to do everything they can.
Yeah. I call it more of an election cycle, but I noticed this in election years since I started trading in 1962.
Right.
Pretty strong pattern of that little November, the way we react to markets.
Right. Now, what about any of the noise out there from, you know, you hear that, for example, copper stockpiles are out of control in China, or you see that there's, the oil situation is, we're back to about 105 on oil. Is that, where do you sit on that? Is oil rightly priced at this point?
Well, I think oil is overpriced. I would expect the weakness in the energy, maybe to help Obama get reelected. I don't know. But I know that the commercials, the large producers and users of energy have been shorting this market or hedging short positions, tends to mean lower prices. So I can't be wildly bullish. Though it's funny, on a short-term basis, I am long crude oil.
Right.
But I'm looking at for some type of a intermediate-term high in here coming up. They're not there yet, but I wouldn't be in the least bit surprised to see that take place.
Well, let's talk about the dog of the world, which had a pretty good pop last week, which was natural gas. Is the most unpredictable bugger, except for the fact that it always goes down for the last however.
Yeah, that's a prediction that stays short. The ultimate contrarian play would be to be long Apple and short Apple and long natural gas.
Oh, yeah. Wow, that's almost you'd have to have your head examined.
The market's in a downtrend. Until the market bases, fortunes have been lost waiting for the bottom, buying a bottom early. So, my strategy is, hey, I'm on the sidelines until the dagger stops quivering in the floor. I don't want to buy it.
Yeah, there's, and that dagger has a lot of blood around it.
It certainly does.
Yeah. Green blood, that is. Yeah. What other commodities you find of interest right now that we can, where's the play that you're
looking for? A buy in coffee. I don't have it. I'm not in the position there yet, but I would expect we're going to get a buy point in coffee. I'd like to see that develop. I'm really confused.
Cutting out
got
again.
To buy or sell this.
Yeah.
And you look at the market, we've just been basically in a flat trading range. There's nothing really set up to have just a screaming rip in the marketplace.
Right. So what is it, coffee? No, it's not coffee. Is coffee down 18% this year to date? No, it's something else. It's
Coffee's been down for the year. Yeah.
Pretty well. It's the worst. I think it's one of the worst commodities, right?
Gas, but that's the problem. Been a big downtrend, but it's based now for the last 25, 30 days or so. So I'm looking at it, but.
And when you deal with this, do you have to deal with all sorts of rain reports and crop reports? And there's a lot of moving parts to this.
You have earnings reports and rumors and all sorts of stuff in the stock market. You always have news out there. I really don't pay much attention to the news. I don't read any newspapers. My mentor is the market. I'm just looking at, I trade what's in front of me. And there's all stuff is there, but I don't pay attention to it.
I think that's a good point because you can get very sidetracked by reading, listening. I got to tell you something. I read for enjoyment. I read for the pleasure of kind of knowing but some of the stuff you read, you're like, oh, why am I, what is this?
Gets pretty pessimistic after a while. I love the Drudge Report and all that stuff, but after a while, I go, oh, man, this is a bummer.
I don't mind the pessimistic side, Larry. I don't mind the pessimistic side or the optimistic side, but I don't like the always pessimistic or the always optimistic. In other words, give me a straight scoop.
Yeah.
But that seems to depends on who you want to listen to. CNBC is optimistic even when it's not time to be optimistic.
I have my degree in journalism, and I think that this whole industry has changed so much
It
all represents viewpoints now as news is reporting somebody's viewpoint
right.
with a strong bias. I mean, you have Fox on one side. When this is interesting, Fox is really is owned by Rupert.
Yeah, Murdoch, yeah.
That's his views of what's right and wrong for America, and he's a foreigner. And then we have George Soros, who's on the liberal side, working in the media to get his views. We have two non-Americans fighting for America. Well, they're American citizens now, but non-natural Americans fighting for the future of America in the media. There's an interesting battle between these two guys.
Well, I mean, I guess it serves us right. I mean, we've been in everybody's business for how long?
Uh-huh.
Right? We've been
there. We have military bases in, 100 countries around the world.
Right, exactly.
How we feel if China had a military base in America, I don't think we'd like it.
Right, no, not at all. Not at all. Okay, so, when it comes to the commodities markets and all that, is there a point that you think that gas prices are going? I mean, the refinery production is down, right? It's been down a lot. Refining has been down recently, and that's obviously one of the reasons. Gasoline inventories are pretty high, aren't they?
Yeah, I think you're finally going to get some production. I think that's going to be the good news. But when we look at that Lenletta gasoline contract, the RB contract now, it's really broken pretty badly in here. It's rallying up. We see the small speculators are really long this market. I think we're going to see it move to the downside. Hopefully we'll get more production coming. We have more exploration going on. We have the Balkan Basin, which is massive. And hopefully, assuming Romney gets elected, we're going to see more exploration and refining in America.
One of the things that is happening is all the fracking and all that. And that's been good for conceptually adding to the inventories and more of a lack of dependence on foreign oil. And of course, that's been also, helping to increase the natural gas inventories, which and drilling. But one of the companies we follow is Carbo Ceramics, which we actually sold last week because this kind of at a point where it hit a very critical level, and I said, you know what, if it goes below this, and we kind of did some modeling of it, it's gone, and It did. It kind of fell over a cliff right afterwards. And they make a lot of the parts and piping and various things that go into the fracking business. There's a lot of hoopla going on about fracking these days. It's causing earthquakes. It could be spilling of this or that into the systems. What's your take on that?
Well, I think, clearly we know now that within the Department of Energy, there has been a concerted effort to squelch producers in the industry, now that we know from the notes of their meetings where they've said, we're going to go out and kill them. Mm. We're going to kill this industry. Well, they've been doing it.
Yeah.
Fortunately, they got caught. So That's going to help a lot.
Right.
I also think that we've reached a point where you're always going to have the anti-environmental or the environmentalists, the anti-productivity people who are always going to be squelching out there. Fortunately for them, they've had a president that supported their argument.
Right.
But I think that's going to change. I think the big deal is going to win the election.
Mm.
And that is a game changer in terms of energy production, in terms of the U.S. dollar, in terms of stock market, in terms of a lot of stuff. I think that he's going to turn this around, and that's the big issue this year.
Yeah, I hear you. All right, well, Larry from I Really Trade, I appreciate that. Now, how do people get your reports and things? Just go to I Really Trade, or what's the
Just go to our website, ireallytrade.com. There's the jillion free things on there. Read that, see if the shoe fits. I'm not for everybody, that's for sure. I am a pretty practical guy, and
I appreciate it, and I love you. I love your work.
It's very thank you very much.
I appreciate it. All right, bye-bye.
Okay, thanks much. Bye.
All right, that's going to wrap it up for the discussion today. I'll mention that we're going to have some great guests coming up. Frank Hersey is going to be up in a couple of weeks. And we have some other really exciting guests that we have lined up. I'm not going to tell you all about them because I want you to come back, but we do. And some of your favorites that we had on from last year, we had Doss last week, of course, and we're going to bring back some of the folks that we haven't had on for some time to bring us some of the insight, what they think of the markets. I talked to John Najarian last week. We're going to have him on again soon. Fausto Puglisi is going to be on. Who else do we have on our list? I know there's a couple other names there, but next 3 or 4 weeks I know is pretty filled up. So until then, of course, we'll see you around. Make sure to check out DH Unplugged as well. We talked John C. Dvorak, that is, on Tuesdays and Wednesdays. Or Wednesdays you'll get the actual podcast. If you haven't done so already. And don't forget about the offer for May. We will give you a copy of The Disciplined Investor and The Winning Investor for anybody that signs up for a subscription to Trigger Point Research. Thanks so much for joining me. We'll see you again very soon. Have a great week. Check out thedisciplinedinvestor.com because we put some pieces up about the market trend. We're going to talk about some economics and some stocks that are of interest. Thanks for joining me. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.